Okay, so some of you were here last week. If you weren't, it was great. Go back and listen. But for those of you that weren't, we'll just do a brief introduction. And by way of introduction, we're also going to do guess that fun fact. We're going to mix it up and see who the fun fact goes with. So first of all, we have our co-lead pastor, Dave Gunlock. Title in work, Rob Johnson. And then Trevor, I forget your title. Trevor does a lot too. So Trevor Lawrence, they're all here. They're all wonderful. Tap into them. They're a great resource that we all have at this church. Okay, so we are going to do, by raise of hands, guess that fun fact. So I'm going to read off the fun fact, and you guys will guess who it is about. All right, here we go. This first fun fact is, I'm the only one on staff without an iPhone. Hashtag Green Lives Matter. So by raise of hands, who thinks that this is Trevor? Lauren Petrelli, like, almost raise your hand. Okay, who thinks this is Rob Johnson? The fact that it's funny makes it even better. Okay, and last but not least, who thinks this is Dave Gunlock? Okay, we got split between Rob and Dave. This feels a little ageist.
You can't answer this yet, though, right?
Oh.
You got to do all three.
Oh, okay, that's a good way. I'm glad you said that. Okay, so that was the first one. Okay, next fun fact. okay, I don't... We just sound really cool on this panel already. I don't like large crowds. So hey, we know you're out there. So prefer to avoid live sports events or... Or concerts, unless it's live concerts. Raise of hands, who thinks this is Trevor? I'm sorry, you're like not hearing it because I'm laughing too much. I can't even see it. Yeah. Hate people. No, I don't like large crowds, so prefer to avoid live sports events or concerts. Or church or pastoring. So those of you that think this is Trevor, raise of hands.
Absolutely not.
All right, Mr. Cool Guy, iPhone, loves concerts. Who thinks this is Rob?
I feel like some of you raised your hands for both of those.
Rob's the introvert at home with his Android. Okay, and then who thinks this is Pastor Dave? Just Lauren Brooks. Okay, and Bryn. And his mom. Loud noises. Okay, and then the last fun fact we have. This pastor's first kiss became a contestant on The Bachelor.
What?
Right? This is good. So raise of hands. Who thinks Trevor's first kiss became a contestant on The Bachelor? This should just be like a hip to least hip questionnaire. Okay, who thinks Rob's first kiss became a contestant on The Bachelor? And then who thinks Dave's first kiss became a contestant on The Bachelor? Emily Maynard, the first one. No. Okay. So how should we go about revealing this? Should I just, I'll come up. Okay. So if this is you, please take a stand and elaborate on this story. All right. First up, we got... I'm the only one on staff without an iPhone. Hashtag Green Lives Matter. Please stand up. How does that feel, being the only one who gets like multiple texts of likes? And
truly, in Orange County, it's rare to experience persecution as a Christian. This is my one form of persecution, and I get it all the time, and it's strengthening my faith.
So good. Okay, next up. Who does not like large crowds, so prefers to avoid live sports events or concerts? Please stand up. And by the way, at the end of his thing, he also said, unless it's loving to my wife, but I didn't want to give it away.
I think I have a legitimate like existential crisis every time I'm at a large sporting event where I'm like, there's so many people here and I don't know them. And then I freak out and then I don't like it. I just would prefer to be at home and watch whatever it is that's going, and I think concerts are overrated.
I love it. Unless it's loving to Natalie. So that means Last but not least, all you haters who thought he was an android introverted geek, Rob actually had his first kiss on The Bachelor. Rob, will you please elaborate?
Just to be clear, it wasn't the male, right? I don't know the season or anything like that, but she tried to troll the show.
Ashley like, M or something? I feel like they're always like Ashley.
Her name was Mandy. Mandy.
So she was there for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Her motives were not pure. Yeah.
Troll the show.
Troll meaning like it was a joke to her. She wasn't she made this great video, which I wish I could find because it actually is hilarious to get onto the show, and then I think they just knew she would be a perfect cast member. Nice. So she was she's a dentist, so she tried to do dental work on him in the. No, that is not her.
For the rest of this morning, Taylor will not be paying attention. Yeah. She'll just be finding Mandy, the dentist.
Mandy Kramer. My wife picked that fact for me, by the way, also.
So good.
That's impressive if you remember her. She wore a giant rose, hat. There she is.
Airdrop that, Kels. Airdrop it. Overflow office, okay? We need that up on the screen. Just kidding. Rob would never kiss someone that would take that show serious. Only the ones that would troll it.
This was seventh grade, okay? I didn't know what...
So good. So anyways, we are going to go through the rest of the questions that we didn't get to last week. And then, Jenny, what time am I supposed to be done at? All right. And table time. We heard your cries. We love our pastors, but we love table time more, and we will give that to you today, okay? Okay, you guys ready? Because there's still the same amount of depth. But you guys are going to do great. We're so excited. ChatGPT.
All our answers are AI generated, so.
I was just going to say, if something like hits you before 10:25 that you want to interact with, that's your question, let's do that. Like we don't even remember what these questions are. We're catching them all off the cuff pretty much. So I would just say that.
Great. So if that's your question, you got follow up or it's striking you, raise a hands. Let's go there. All right. So we are going to start out this Tuesday morning with, where was it? I thought this was perfect for today. Sorry, guys. Some incest. Was all man created through Adam and Eve? And if so, does that mean creation started with incest? Good morning.
I mean, yeah, it does. There's different theories or thoughts on that. I mean, I think you do have to start with Adam and Eve, but it's part of the creation mandate, right? I think some people would say that the genetic line was more pure and had not broken down as much. There's trouble with that, right? So all I would say is it's an uncomfortable reality that you have to accept, I think.
No, there's a lot of people have different takes on the early chapters of Genesis. One alternative take is that we are not seeing, well, in any biblical passage, you're never seeing the whole story. You're getting a very narrow focus on what the author thinks is most important for us to know. Every story of Jesus, think about all the gospel stories, you're getting a very narrow insight into that. Like Jesus meets with Nicodemus. That's the story where Jesus says you have to be born again. And he's like, well, you can't get into your mother's womb a second time, you know. And that's like 16 verses in John 3. So that's like it takes you, you know, a minute to read. But I promise you that conversation was 3 hours long. You know, it was a night conversation. And so what John, the writer, is doing is he is giving us a very faithful summary of the essence of that conversation. But if you'd been there, of course, the conversation was much more than what you're seeing. So that's true in any time someone puts pen to paper, you are making decisions about what to share and what not to. So there's nothing that shouldn't create any nervousness for us. It's utterly faithful to the heart of what happened. But so some people, I think there are certainly Christians that would hold to that, that in Genesis 2, with the creation of Adam and Eve, we are being given insight into that story right there. And then you have these questions about, you know, then they have their son, Cain and Abel, their sons, and Cain murders Abel, and he's worried about who might hurt him now. So he kind of goes off to this place that they kind of describe as a city. And so you're like, well, how did that get there? So the Genesis account has some factors in it that you might kind of step back and go, I wonder if I'm only seeing the part of the story I need to see. But I'm not sure if I'm seeing the whole story. That is a perspective that some Christians hold that would say Adam and Eve are kind of the quintessential starting point of human race, but that's maybe there's other things happening that we're just not given insight into. The challenge with that view is that in Acts 17, Paul is preaching to a group of people who know nothing about God, and he basically says, hey, there's a God, he made everything, and from one man, he made every race of men and human beings and determined their course. So it seems that Paul has taken that Genesis story to be literally, this is the couple that started the human race. And so I tend not to go against Paul, because I think he probably knows more about the story than I do. So, but those are some of the things that Christians have to weigh and to consider. And so then you are left with, well, yeah, if you're going to start a human race from a couple, then by definition, there has to be some wonky starts until you kind of spread out and move from there.
All right. Can you explain from a Christian perspective the sequence of events that happens when you die? What are all the steps that take place before you enter heaven?
Have you been there? What? Have you been there? Death?
Not yet. I won't give the sequence, but I will say an interesting tidbit, and then I'll pass it to Pastor Dave. So Paul often describes a moment where when you die, well, he says those who are asleep in death. And I do think that there's something to whatever our imagination is of what happens when we die, we really don't know. There's not details to that, but there is a description of prior to resurrection and judgment that those who have fallen asleep in death will be raised again. And I think that's interesting because there's a lot of mystery to that. But whatever sleep is, there's kind of a conscious, non-conscious presence that's happening in sleep. And I think that's interesting. And then you have a lot of denominational differences of what happens in between with purgatory or whatever it may be. But I think it's interesting that, that sleep is the most clear analogy to what happens when we die. And then after that, there's a lot of things that go down.
Do you have other things?
Sure, I do. But you could.
So I my view would be that if you believe in Jesus Christ, when you die, you go to be with the Lord. You don't have a body. Your spirit, you know, we think of our spirit. Our spirit goes to be with the Lord. Paul says, I'd rather depart and be with Christ, which is far better than staying around here. He says, to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord. So you, so people that you love who believe in Jesus who have died, I believe that they are in the presence of the Lord without they haven't gotten their resurrection bodies. So they are free of pain. They are full of joy. They're in the presence of the Lord. But they, like us, still have something to look forward to, which is Jesus returning, which if you're here on Sundays, that's what we're talking about. When Christ returns, the new heavens, the new earth, the renewal of all things, at that point, they get their resurrection bodies, which are like the bodies that Jesus got when he was raised, right? So he got a resurrection body out of the tomb, and it had a lot of similarities to his old body, but clearly some differences, and it was like a 2.0 version of embodied existence. And so I think that's what, when Christ returns, those who have fallen asleep will get their resurrection bodies, and then we will all together live on this, in the new heavens and the new earth, and will reign on a new earth, which is what Adam and Eve were called to do at the beginning, right? You go multiply, fill the earth, and rule over it. This is what we'll do. We'll rule together over this beautiful new creation. So that will be the final story. But the sequence, as I understand it, is you die, you're with, it's the sleep is the metaphor. I think it's a disembodied but spiritual experience of being with the Lord. And then you get your resurrection body when Christ returns. I don't know if, I think that's the question. We're not looking into like pre-trib, post-trib, all that kind of stuff. I think that wasn't the question they were asking. So,
yeah. If you want to.
Nope.
I actually have a tiny follow-up to that. So, N.T. Wright in Surprised by Hope discusses very in-depth how the earth will be made new, and this is where heaven actually will be, like heaven on earth. So with that being said, your spirit, you know, as little kids, we imagine heaven up in the sky, outside of the universe, whatever. Where do we think the spirits who are with God before the new body and the new resurrected earth are?
Where are they?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That may be a non-answer, but
I don't have an answer. I mean, we think of heaven as up there. By definition, the spiritual realm is not confined to the space-time continuum. So it's like another realm of, like another dimension of, right, yeah, it's sort of that sort of, I think, all we can envision is up. All that the ancient people could envision is up. Now we know up really isn't up or down. We're in the middle of a universe that down might as well be up and up might as well be down. So we're talking about, a different dimension of reality that we can't, non-physical, that we can't really imagine. It's like, I mean, I was thinking about this week, like if you have a friend who's blind, let's say, they have access to four of their senses, but there's a whole other sense that they don't have. And I was trying to think of how would you describe what seeing is like to someone who has access to their touch and their smell and their taste and their hearing? I don't even know how you, like, how do you, I don't even know how to describe it. Exactly. So it's that's almost like another, that's not another dimension, like it's a, right, it's another sense that can't even, I don't even know, it's like here, so it's, that's how, I mean.
Incomprehensible.
Yeah.
all right, we're going to stay on the heaven, hell theme. Let's see this one. As someone who has studied the Bible, what do you believe heaven is like? Is it full of condominiums? Do we spend eternity doing our favorite things? Will we all be like monks and nuns where our time revolves around worship? How will we all be in the presence of God? Do you think we will have bodies? We kind of touched on that. What are your thoughts?
I think you should come to church on Sunday.
Yeah, right?
I think this is... Honestly, I think you should listen to what Dave's been talking about because I think that'll give you a good vision or imagination for it. I think for me, what's been comforting is it's, and maybe this isn't comforting to other people, it's more earthy than I was raised to think that it was. So I remember when I first really started to grasp the idea of heaven coming to earth, I was extremely hopeful and excited about what that world would look like. And I think Dave has only reignited my imagination for that for the last couple weeks. So I think whatever it is, it's going to be infinitely better than anything that we can understand or experience right now. And so I've tried to even take in really good moments in my life and imagine, like, that's, I'm getting close, you know, but not like so far from it, but like I'm scratching the surface of what that will feel like. And so like what the practical, you know, realities of that will be, I don't know. I think we're all trying to figure that out. But do you have anything, Trevor? You have lots.
Yeah, no, just that. I think there will be more continuity than we think with this, like, you will recognize one another. You will not, it's not like your memory is going to be erased, right? It's going to be the renewal and the redemption and the healing of this old order of things. And it will be entirely different, and we can't comprehend it. But I think one of the, we were just talking last night, we were with some friends, and, you know, Jesus says there will be no marriage in heaven, and which I think makes a lot of us sad. Like, wait, what's that about? And I have some thoughts on why that is, but I think what we can guarantee is your relationship with your husband will be better in eternity than it is today, even though the institution of marriage dissolves. But your relationship will be better, not worse, in eternity. It'll be more redeemed, and so and on and on. Yeah.
Secret was all along he created a union between a man and a wife to point to a more important union, which was going to be the union that Jesus wanted to have with his bride, the church. And once the real thing comes, the foreshadow drops off, because now we're getting the real thing. Yeah.
I would also say that I think when you start thinking about life more in a more earthy way, and you start looking especially at the way Jesus talks, so much of what he says is that, like, I think the investing terms are pretty common. Like, what you are sowing now, you're going to reap in the future, you know? And like the idea of like investing into a heavenly kingdom where moth and rust can't destroy, like that language is everywhere. And so, I think there is an element of like how we spend our time, our resources, the life that we've been given now will reap itself in different ways. And so invest your life wisely. You know, I think that's a lot of what Jesus is saying. It's like you have this small window of time that will then reap itself into the eternal life that you've got. And I think of like a seed falling to the ground, and like a lot of what you are doing right now is like you're in seed form. And so what you sow into the ground is what will, you know, spring from the ground when we get to eternity. And so I've been inspired by that personally more and more lately. Like, let's just throw off the things that seem like they matter. But ultimately, like, when I get to that side of things, I'll go like, why did I waste my time? You know, like that's, I don't think I'll be burdened by it, but I don't want to ever have a sense of like I could have invested more, you know.
Super good. I'm actually going to, Rob touched on it, but I just want to show you guys, for those of you that don't go to Greece on Sundays, I just wanted to show you, Dave's in the middle of a series called Eternity to, From Here to Eternity, not to be confused with the 1970s movie. It's a really great sermon, and if you don't go here, you can still go and listen to it. So if you go to those three dots, go to Sunday Sermons, and then the great thing is you can actually look at Dave's notes, which is great. So anyways, go here, listen to some of his sermons, and then you can download it, get his notes. Well, I did it while they were talking, so don't give me too much credit. But and you can literally like look at the notes, listen to the sermon, because it really is good. And it's just, I think how we were raised viewing heaven was so different than what the Bible actually says. And Dave's doing a really great job at breaking it down and making your brain a little more excited and work harder for that image. So anyways, I just wanted to point that out. Okay. Oh, whoops. Now I'm giving away all the questions. Okay. How to explain God is just a just God by allowing hell? Rob's really looking to you, Trev.
Oh, I was just, if he wanted the mic, he could have it. Okay. I think there's a lot to these questions. Where context would matter, why they're asking that question. I think the premise of God's justice and sin makes hell a pretty logical answer to the question. So to me, I guess I wonder, like, what is underneath the question? How, like, why couldn't God or why would God send someone to hell? I think a lot of people wrestle with the idea that they've got a loved one who they feel like was a pretty decent person and lived a pretty good life, and yet here they are, based on our teachings, they're in hell, and they're going to be there for eternity. That's a hard thing to reconcile and to wrestle with. And so I don't think it's difficult, at least for me, to accept the idea that, I think you have to start with the basic premise that as human beings, the idea that any of us are good is not a biblical idea, mm-hmm. right? All of us are sinful human beings. So by nature, we have rebelled against God and we deserve wrath. So grace is like not a prerogative, or not something that God has to offer. And that question often pits it in a different way, where it says, how could God send us to hell with the assumption that we're good or mostly good? And I just fundamentally disagree with that idea. I think it's really hard to accept that, and it's been hard for me to accept that. So I say all these things, I feel like I sound harsh, and I prefer to ask to talk about these things in person with people, because I like to know where the question is coming from. I think you can chat GPT this question and figure out intellectually, hell is coherent, right? It's not hard to accept, but it's hard to accept emotionally a lot of times for us. And it's also really hard to accept that we're sinners, and that every single person is a sinner, and that some people will die apart from God's grace. That's a hard thing to accept. It's a hard thing that I don't understand. And so there's an element of that that I leave to God's prerogative, and I don't question. And I think trying to answer it in this context is really difficult, because it's, I don't think, fully satisfying to anybody.
I feel like this is the hardest thing in the faith, or for many of us. I think of something that is said about Jesus in the Gospels, where someone says he does all things well. And I love that. And I think what in Jesus says, God has entrusted judgment to the Son, to Jesus. And so what we trust is that Jesus does all things well, even justice. He does love. He does mercy. He does all things well. And so we have a kind and just Savior who can do this better than any of us could. And I would agree with everything you said. And I would say none of us knows what hell is. And we are, as with heaven, as if you guys are here on Sundays, you hear me say this, what we're being given is images to describe something that is not quite the images themselves. And so I'm just going to keep going. I know this is hard, but Jesus talks about hell more than anybody in Scripture. And what he gives us is images. And once you start thinking about the images, you realize, oh, that's the thing is not quite these things. Like, he gives, one of the images is fire. There's this eternal fire. Another image is outer darkness. And you think about those two images, those don't work together, right? Where there's fire, there's light. So the two images are mutually exclusive. They contradict each other. So right there, you realize, okay, these are just images to give us something. He talks about being separated from the presence of the Lord, which is hard to imagine since the Lord is everywhere. And then the other language we get is the language of destruction or perishing. John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have life. So we're being given images of something, and we don't know what that something is. I think it's what we do see, I think we would all say as biblical Christians, it does seem that there is a eternal life, and not everybody receives it. So there are some views like everyone eventually gets to heaven. And I think I think as biblical Christians, I don't think we could embrace that. Mm-hmm. Whatever hell is, it's not something that you can, that everyone's coming out of to this other place, the good place. So we have to hold to that. But precisely what it is, we don't know.
And there's a lot of different ways of working through it. So, but I would just say he does all things well. And we know his character in the Gospels. We can watch him at work. And we could say that same person is in charge of how this goes down. And so we entrust those things to him and trust in his goodness and his justice. And it's really hard.
I also think it's important to say, I don't think he takes pleasure in people going to hell. Right? Like I don't think he's sitting there hoping to put people in hell. Right? I think that his predominant way of talking about himself is compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, loyal, faithful. And that is his disposition, that there's an overflow, I would say an overflow of love in terms of his why he even created. He didn't create out of need. He doesn't need hell, right? So that, I think, is just important to keep in mind when you think about God sending people to hell, not that it necessarily helps.
I'm going to repeat that just for the recording. How did you explain that to your kids, and around what age did you do that?
Great question. I never had a formal conversation with my kids. I've let them kind of pick up the concepts through reading storybook Bibles or different things like that over time, and then we've just kind of teased out the ideas. And the only reason for that is when I was young, I feel like hell was like blasted in front of me. And it was like, if you don't accept Jesus, you are going to hell. And so I basically bought fire insurance from a very young age. And I think my faith suffered for that. Like I had a very angry understanding of God's disposition towards me and the world, and lived with that for a really long time. And I wasn't compelled by the goodness of God or the purity of God, the greatness of God, like none of that until much later in life when those ideas kind of became real to me. And I want my kids to be compelled in that way as much as they can be. So I try to spend most of my time talking about God and his goodness and contrasting that with sin that they experience in the world all over the place. And to emphasize that God is a God of justice and a God of love and a God of mercy. And that's what they're pursuing. And there is this reality of hell that exists. And maybe I'm wrong in doing it that way, but it's definitely, it was so impactful for me as a kid that's kind of shaped how I've approached it. You want?
Well, I haven't talked to my Lily's 4.5, but but in terms of, I think, the context of youth ministry with junior hires and high schoolers, I think what, this kind of goes for any of these questions too, but most of their vision of hell and heaven is not shaped by their reading the Bible with their parents or anything like that. It's very kind of like hot take type stuff or things now that they see on the internet or whatever it is. So I do think developing a worldview of heaven and hell from what the Bible actually has to say. And so you have to read really hard things that Jesus says and not try to clean them up and allow for questions and be able to say, like, I don't know that answer about heaven, or I don't know that answer about hell. Because I think that's something that it takes like 3 years of junior high where we're reading the Bible with them on Wednesday nights, Sundays, where to get them out of whatever, just to say what they think about it versus, or to be surprised, like, oh, that's actually what the Bible has to say, and that's not true of every junior high schooler. But the difference that I see is families that actually read the Bible together versus families that try to build a systematic theology before reading the Bible makes it really difficult. You have to, like, untangle the ideas, or you're like, wait a second, Jesus says this, but my parents said this. And that, you definitely don't want to be in that scenario, but...
Sorry, I just don't want to miss this. So important to read the Bible, cover to cover. I'm so passionate about that. How do you, can you give us a proposition of how, as a family, to do that in a way that's not overwhelming and not scary?
Yes. Yeah, so I think reading the Bible in categories, like genre categories, is really helpful. So you have the Torah, the first five books. You have the minor prophets, major prophets, wisdom literature, which is Psalms and all those. And then you have the New Testament. So I think always being in, like, one of those categories at a time is really helpful, because the themes end up being really similar, where it's like you read one minor prophet, you kind of read all the minor prophets. So, and the themes are pretty basic. I think, obviously, my girls are so young, but from, I think resources like the Bible Project are really helpful to watch a quick video and be like, this is the general flow of what it's about. They also can be overwhelming because they're like 8 minutes, really fast talking. But as kids are getting older, I think doing that and then reading it together. But I think one thing would be not, this would be maybe more personal, but I do think I'm more and more interested in this of emphasizing communal reading over individual, like, quiet time reading. I think is really important for young kids, because all they're hearing is the quiet time, like, you need to be, and I think that's true in terms of prayer and meditating on scripture, and there's certain books that are better for that. Like, the Psalms are great for sitting with a psalm and reading through it. But if you're like, hey, do a quiet time, here's, like, anything but the Psalms, it's really difficult and overwhelming. So, of course, they're going to want, give me an easy answer to the question that I have. But I think, like, we haven't done this yet, but, like, family discussion. Like, so on Wednesday nights, we have a leader who presents the text, and Luke and John will do the setup work of context and show a Bible Project video, whatever it is, and then we just read it and talk about it and try to figure out what it's saying. And usually what comes of that is real questions and at least a step of, like, what do we do with this next? And I think that is a good thing to do when you're reading the Bible, is rather than, kids need help. They're not ready to, like, hold mystery fully. But as they get older, getting to let them sit in the mystery a little bit more and not just answer the question right away. But as they're younger, they need the, like, heaven is real, God is there, you'll be there too if you believe in Jesus. Like, but as they get older and they're already asking the question and they don't want to be protected. So I think part of it is you have to, as a parent, you have to navigate that and not be afraid of them. Like, they're not going to be heretics. They're not going to be, I mean, they might be, but but them asking questions about the Bible is not mean that that's, so if they're like, hell doesn't sound like what you said it was, the answer is not, no, yes, it is what I said it was, and here's the quote from the book I read, or whatever it is, but more like, what is that, yeah, how does that, you're right, that's a really good question, let me look into that, and always, them always knowing that you're always learning and seeking answers, and that the Bible's the starting point, and then trusted resources and commentaries and books and things are a great follow-up, but, so I think modeling it, but having a wider vision of, like, reading the Bible is the primary way that we get this, and how we do that is we need to study it, which we need to do that together, and we need to bring in other resources. We need to think about it a lot, like, meditate on it, and we need to memorize it. We need to be immersed in the Bible. And I think that's more and more, like, that's going to be a skill for Christians in 20 years from now. People who know the Bible because they've actually read the Bible is going to be very rare. And I do think there's a difference in the kind of people who actually read the Bible and who know a lot about the Bible. And I'm speaking to myself, but yeah.
Would you really quickly speak to what you experienced in, because you're doing reading the Bible with cognition, so these are, like, before you through to the Bible, so, like, challenges that you're seeing in there, like, hurdles for them reading the Bible, what we could do with
Just for the recording, Natalie's saying, can you explain what you're doing with youth group in reading the Bible for cognition? Is that what you said?
Just like so
and the hurdles that come from...
Before youth group, and you're talking about reading the Bible. So, and we talked about a few of the hurdles that you're...
Hurdles of detangling...
Detangling
assumptions of the Bible.
You say it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the idea of we have a literary faith and how, so reading more than just the Bible, but like reading in general is really important skill because we have a book, a collection of books to read, and reading the different categories and genres of the Bible outside of the Bible. Like, our kids should be reading poetry because the Bible's full of poetry. Our kids should be reading, like, wild imagery because there's wild imagery in the Bible. So just learning to read, that's something that I obviously didn't appreciate until I'm much older, and now I'm, like, trying to learn how to read. But I think that's part of the, yeah, the literary faith. And then I do think the part of study is different from meditation, is different from memorization. It's something I think for kids to really learn of, like, me thinking a long time in the quiet about something I'm reading is different than me trying to seek the answer in community with wise people around me versus memorizing it and what that does. So I think those buckets and that, and then learning so that when you're an adult, you do that together, where you're reading, you're studying and meditating and memorizing all at one time, is maybe like an ideal version of that, but that's something I've thought about, yeah.
Yeah, just compliment that. I think at this stage, the greatest thing you can do is get a good children's storybook Bible and read to your kids before bed or whenever that pocket is. Usually they don't want to go to sleep, so you kind of have a captive audience there. And so they're getting familiar with the stories. And then just to what Trev was saying, I think, and your husband plays a role in this and, you know, how your dynamic works, but to relieve yourself from the burden of having to be the Bible expert for your kids and to say, hey, let's be co-journeyers here. And so you're reading your children's Bible to them, and at some point it's great if you can actually crack open an adult Bible to them. And there's some really basic questions that you can ask of every story together that you can be like, hey, let's ask these together. And you don't have to have the answers. If you're like, I love Trevor, like, hell, I don't know about how hell works. You're like, we don't know. But you can read a story of the Bible or passage and just say, okay, what do we learn about who God is in this passage? Like, let's talk, what do you see there? Simple question, like, what do we learn about what following God entails? What's the good news in this passage? I mean, you could take those three right there and just kind of let those be filters of exploration together. Like, ooh, God's kind of, like, Jesus is kind of stern in this passage. Whoa, why do you think that is? And relieve yourself of having to have the answers, because we don't have the answers most of the time, right? It's like, it's so funny. All the questions that your kids will be asking in the next 5 years are the reasons why people leave the faith. They're all the same. I had a friend who was in my small group, a couples group, years ago. They started volunteering with the kids in Sunday school, and he lost his faith. Wow. Because kids were asking all the normal questions that none of us really got great answers to. We just kind of go into adulthood like, oh, that's what kids always ask. And it tripped him up, and he walked away from the faith. Yeah. So they're asking all the tough questions that there aren't easy answers to, but we can just ask them together, and they will get an experience of mom and dad. Like, hey, mom and dad are on their journey of faith, and we're journeying with Jesus together, working this out together. Obviously, sometimes you still want to be the authority, but it's okay not to have all the answers. And that can kind of, I think so many, especially husbands, can be really intimidated to step into that space. And oftentimes, you wives are just more spiritually mature than your husbands are. You know scripture more than your husbands do. And so that can be a really tough place to try to step into. And yet they feel some pressure, like, I think my wife wants me to do this. I don't really know how to do it. And if you can kind of together go, hey, we don't have to have, you know, free, remove that burden, I think that can be a way to get in.
Such good answers. I love how you guys talk about basically if you want your kids to read the Bible, we got to read the Bible, things like that. This was just one thing that Trevor referenced, the Bible Project. It's these really fun illustrative stories. Sorry, I thought I turned the volume off. But it's great. And so you can, like, reward your kids with that. I loved that idea. But anyways, it talks all about, and it literally draws it out.
So
the Bible Project. If you're doing the Bible recap, that's integrated with the Bible recap. All about reading. Read the Bible. Love that. Literary. Okay. It's 10:25 already. Do we have questions from the crowd, or do you guys want me to maybe do one more from here? We got questions. I love it.
How
talking about, just in terms of like kids asking questions and not knowing how to answer. I have a 9-year-old, and lately she's been saying she doesn't want to pray because she doesn't think God cares or ever answers her prayer. She has like a specific prayer of like wanting like more friends or something, and God doesn't send her someone. So she really took the like, you know, if you ask God to move the mountain will move. Like, she takes that kind of stuff to heart. So it's hard as a mom to, I feel like I'm not giving her a good answer. You know, I say like, well, God sends, you know, people in the right timing, and sometimes his timing's different than our timing, but it's like just very big concepts for a 9-year-old to understand. So is there anything with that kind of specific, because I see her passion for God kind of fading, and that's like heartbreaking. So I just don't know what to, like, if there's any right answer or anything.
Do you have, does anyone have, what's that?
Oh, you have one.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, your kid, so I don't, but I think I wonder if you shared a story with her of unanswered prayers that you've had or have. Like, I think that's the idea of mystery, where it's like being like, yeah, me too. Like, I've prayed for these things and they and God didn't seem to answer them. But can I tell you about ways that he has answered my prayers? So I think if you do the one for one, like, I prayed for this thing, but God didn't show up. Well, hope, I think you would have ideas of where he has too. So, and I think in that scenario, rather than you carrying the burden of her faith, you can appropriately be like, God, you got, like, like, it's on you to do this. But I think the more, as kids get, that's the hard part. I don't know, there's not like an age when you do that. But if she's already asking those kinds of questions, you can tell her, like, I think you're ready to know that, like, God doesn't always, I don't know why, God doesn't always answer the way that, but he is good and he is these things. And so that would be one thing, is to like enter into it with her and make her feel not alone in the idea that like that she's worried about this. And then pray with her, like, can I pray with you too about this? And let's keep praying for friends. And that would be one way to do it. But I do think all of those questions that kids are asking, the ones that we lose our faith over, is they're usually related to the like not being able to hold mystery, like things that aren't, we will never know. Not being able to do that while trusting God. And so I think that is really hard. Yeah. But, yeah. No, that helps a lot.
Other questions?
Just have a comment. I left last week feeling so grateful for our pastors and the access in this setting that we have with you. So thank you for, I just feel like it's so personal, it's so relatable that you took the time to be here, and I think we all feel closer to you by hearing your answers and how you, your wisdom. So thank you. It's this very unique gift that we have here. Thank you.
Apologies in advance. I don't know how to frame the question that I'm asking. So my daughter's almost 2, and we're practicing obedience. And she's getting to the point, she's very much like my husband, very strong-willed. And now she's getting to the point where we tell her no, and she gives us direct eye contact and does the exact thing that we tell her not to do. And so I am foreseeing the future of how do we as parents teach her biblical discipline and like obedience well when we're just like continuously being no, 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 no. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if my question is making sense, but I don't know if you guys have wisdom there.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I like the framework that you gave when you did the parenting thing. Yeah. Do you still remember that?
I have thoughts off the top of my head.
I look out at the world today, I think most of the problems in the world are caused by parents who don't know how to say no to their kids. Like, I look out at the world, I'm like, there was a parent who was so scared to say no to their kid. And that's why this is happening. So I think if you, what you're referring to is, I think by age 2 or age 4, every kid needs to have an answer to 2 basic questions, and they need to be clear in their minds. The first one is, am I loved? Like, and meaning, am I loved? Am I loved exactly as I am? All my faults, all my stuff. Am I loved deeply by mom and dad? Every kid, so many people didn't. Some of you in this room never had a clear answer to that question, and that causes such hurt and so much wounds. And the other question I think every 2 to 4 year old needs to have answered is, who's in charge? Am I in charge? Is mom in charge? Are we both? Is this a democracy? And that is identical to the two answers, the 2 questions we need to have answered with God. Am I loved? Am I? And who's in charge of this thing? And so, the techniques and the strategies of discipline are so, you know, like you said, you know your kid. You have to find the ways that work. You don't want to exasperate your children, but you're right in that phase, and she knows what she's doing, right? Like, they know what they're doing before you think they know. Like, does she know? It's like, no, she knows. And so those are hard, right? I mean, we're going to, and they just wear you down, right? Kids just wear you down. And so you start finding yourself saying things or not doing things you promised you'd never do because you're so stinking tired. So how of that is tough. But I do think that I don't even like framing it as a battle. But I will say I do believe it's the right battle to fight. And you want to do it graciously. You want to do it. And there's different ways to do it. You know, I mean, there's, at some point you have to find some pain point for them that they respond to, whatever that form of pain is. And it could be many different things. So I do think I just walk around seeing children whose parents aren't parenting. And now I have 3 girls, and my girls have all sorts of problems because we're not perfect parents. But they observe kids in classes whose, you know, parents for whatever reason couldn't parent them or didn't parent them. And I'm like, that's a bummer for that kid. That kid's not set up well to thrive because someone either wasn't around, they couldn't be, or they just didn't have the strength to say no. It's so hard to be the bad guy, you know. And sometimes you have to be the bad guy. That's what I said when I came in and I did my first one, right, and I had my series of fill in the blanks. It was sometimes you just have to be the bad guy.
Actually, I'm going to pause real quick. Someone texted in a question. So from...
Can I?
Sorry, can I just comment really quick on, like, a backup of what they just said?
Sure.
Really, really quickly. Really. Just before we move on. Okay, so I just got this great advice from a girl named Erin Kunkel that used to speak, and maybe she spoke before. But she mentioned the obedience that we teach our kids to have with us at age 2, at the young age, is prepping them and teaching them for the obedience that they are going to have with Christ and with God as they grow up. And I have an 11-year-old now. And as hard as it was to say no, and I still struggle in that, because of course we want to make them happy and all the things, that is just a direct reflection of the obedience that they're going to have with the Lord. So if that's any motivation of, I don't really want to say no because I want to make them happy, or it's a lot easier to just give in, always think like futuristically, but I'm teaching them now the obedience that they're going to have with Christ, because the parenting is the preparation for that. So I just wanted to like mention that because I feel like that was super impactful for me.
That's good.
Thanks.
Kelsey, can I say one thing too?
Yes, you can.
You really want to ask that question? I would also say discipline is a gift to your children, and they will experience it that way as they get older. But something that I've paid attention to just in the role that I used to have here, families pastor, there is a proliferation of parenting content available to you, particularly as Christians. And one of the lies that I think that has fed is this idea that there is a methodology that will produce a perfect child. And that is a complete lie, because all of your children are different, and there will be different circumstances that will lead each of them to become the kind of person that God intends for them to be. And He uniquely gifted each of you to be the mother to the children that he's given you, and you know them, you know the context specifically. So there isn't a methodology, and that's why I like Dave's answer, because it's a framework that's biblical and true, but it applies to all of you, you know, regardless of your child and your circumstances. I mean, some of you might have kids, what am I allowed to say nowadays? Special needs, is that even allowed? Or, you know, like, what's the neurodiversity? Yeah, like you might experience that at some point, and you're going to have to make different choices for how you raise your child, you know, that will look different to other people. So, I think we just need to have grace for each other. This is really hard to do, and you will make mistakes and screw up. And my friend Matt Heim, who's a therapist, always says, like, you actually don't have to get it right. I forget the number, but you actually don't have to get it right, like, very often for you to actually succeed as a parent. Yeah, right here.
Hilarious.
Jeez. 30%. That's what he said. Yeah, you get it right 30% of the time, you will be a good parent. So you guys are doing well, and
love some data.
Discipline your kids.
Okay, so my question is a little going on a different topic, but as like leaders of our specific church, I'm curious if God is showing you what our church's like greatest sin or temptation is, and also what our greatest strength is as a body.
Is this a personal answer?
Of course. Yeah, I mean, we probably all have got answers to that.
I know that we talked before about the Laodicean problem. So, the Laodicean problem, meaning that we're a church that experiences a lot of wealth, and so there's a lot of comfort, especially spiritually, that comes with that complacency that exists. And we've talked about that. One of the things that I think comes with that, because I experience a lot of generosity in our church. You know, like I think there is a temptation, obviously, where we live towards the good life being a life where we get everything we want and, you know, all that. I think the bigger danger is autonomy. And that's what I think wealth means for a lot of people, as I experience it. It's the freedom to make choices the way that it puts me in the seat to make choices for my life, how I want to live my life. And wealth uniquely allows you to feel freedom from God's authority in your life and to justify decisions that if you didn't have that money, I think it would be a lot clearer to you. Now, that doesn't mean that wealth equates itself to that. I just think when I look at our church and what I see and experience of people, and I mean this with love and grace, I feel this for myself. Like there is a temptation towards autonomy, particularly as it means to abide in Christ and to follow his authority and his leading in our life.
I'd say similar. Jesus tells the parable of the sower. Remember that one where a guy sows seed and there's, you know, falls on different soils. And the third soil is it's sown among these thorns crop up. And the thorns choke out the seed. And he says that third soil relates to the person who hears the word, kind of hears the gospel. But he says the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of wealth choke it out and make it unfruitful. And so I think that is, we live in just this amazing, Orange County is a unique place. And so there's all this distraction and there's all this wealth and there's all this busyness. And so we are so just caught up in the things of the world that you lose sight of seeking first the kingdom. And it's when there's such good opportunity available to you outside the kingdom, that's just a massive distraction. And that, so you've got some faith, but you don't have this thriving faith because it's just crowded out by all the options of the world, similar to what you said. I think one of our strengths, though, that being said, I think we have a very, the word I'd use, we have a very grounded community here. And I it's interesting to have more and more people coming to our church because I get to hear people's kind of first impressions of our community. And I think one of the things that people appreciate is you guys feel just really grounded. You don't feel like you're trying to, you're not chasing the newest thing. You know, you're not trying to, even this guy came recently, he's like, you guys feel so authentic, but you're not talking about authentic. Like all these churches are talking about being authentic. You shouldn't have to talk about being authentic. You should just be authentic. I was like, that's an interesting observation. And I do think that our people are grounded, thoughtful people. I think if you enter into this community, you will find some really generous people, some really loving, really thoughtful people. And I think that, so there's a stability to our church that I think is one of our strengths.
Well, it's hard to parse through like our community and then like I'm thinking of me and then I'm thinking of leader. Like there's a lot of, like it's muddled in that. So Rob's personal sin. Well, I'll think of something. So the building stuff has been uniquely, like, just processing through that has been interesting. And so, like, we're over 40 years old as a church. Is that true? Am I right about that? Yeah. So, and, like, my family's been a part of the church for that whole time. And so I think a strength of our church is just, like, slow, grounded growth. Like we have deep roots as a church community. And I think on the flip side of that coin, like we don't know how, like I have a hard time, like as a community, we're not, the word I can't stop thinking about is just ambitious. Like I think ambition's really scary in anything following Jesus. Ambition's really scary, but I do think there's something about a church that isn't just looking to stay kind of insulated and like our people, my people, but to really be like, how does God want to use our church? Not just for us, but for the world. And I think out of 16 churches on Red Hill, like we've been here, haven't had a pastoral scandal, thank God. Like there hasn't been, and like God's been really gracious to our church. So I think that this next season is a season of like, how is God using our church for our church and for the community and for the world? And God has already done that, like apart from ambition. So I think there's a humility, but like a holy ambition of like, we need to lean into like more expectation of what God could do through us. And that's not just leadership. That's like our whole community being like, how is God gonna use us? Rather than just, it's a nice place to be. Like that I think is big. Strength would be the rooted groundedness that I think over the years. And then I will say, like, this may be, I don't know, it kind of feels cliche, but I think the intergenerational dynamic of our church is an untapped strength in a lot of ways of, like, we really do have 0 to 100. And that's a really hard, I think there's ways where churches can be, like, if you want to be a diverse church, that has to be your thing. Like, you have to be, like, we are the diverse church. And especially in a non-diverse area or whatever it is, or if you want to be, there's a lot of things. And then there's just kind of like a gift of like, this is just what we've become. And I think intergenerational is one of those things that feels like a strength that almost feels like we haven't fully grasped like the possibilities of what that could be. And again, it's hard because like as we're talking, it's like our minds might be going from like programmatic things, like we should do an event where we're all together or whatever it is. But I think the strength of it is more in the like, in the smaller stuff. But I think what the strength of that is we have the possibility of like spanning 6 generations of of the church in Orange County. And there aren't very many churches that have that where we have 0 and 100. And so how you like draw that along, I think is the next question, but I do think that's a strength.
Part 3 next week. In all seriousness, we didn't get to 11 questions, and I'm really sorry, but a few encouragements. If you have one of those questions, talk about it amongst your table and your mentor moms. I mean, hello, 2 of them birthed 2 of these men. So we've got deep wisdom at our tables. Come to church on Sundays. If you're not coming to our church, come, because we get to hear from Dave more and occasionally Rob and Trevor as well. And then lastly, Yeah, I'd implore you, if it's okay with you guys, to send an email. Like, if there's a question, I'll send out their addresses later. Just drop by. pick your favorite, email them. No. But in all seriousness, email our pastors. They are wonderful, as you can see, and welcoming, and would totally be up. I mean, I've hit up Dave for flora and fauna treasure hunts, okay? So you can really email them about anything. That's like greenery. Anyway, so thank you so much, guys. And let's go ahead and bless these pastors and pray for them real quick, and then we get table time. Dear God, we're so blessed as a community, Lord, and it's not for anyone's individual skill set, Lord. It's because of your goodness. And we just want to praise you for that, Lord. Praise you for putting these men in leadership at our church. Praise you that they happen to be available for a second week unforeseen. And like Trevor talked about, we've been so blessed as a church. And we just want to pray protection over our leadership and over everyone involved. And Lord, they need wisdom and discernment every day, every hour, every minute. And so we just pray that you give them an abundance of wisdom and discernment. Bless them, bless their marriages, bless their parenthood with their kids, Lord, and protect them, God, as they do your good work. And just be with us as a community, Lord. Continue to give us strong roots. Continue to give us authenticity that is undiscussed. And I just pray that we continue to dig into your word, Lord. And I think the common thread from this morning was read the Bible. Read this gift that you've given us, Lord. So I just pray that as moms in this group, we can encourage one another to be doing that and to be doing it organically with our children, Lord. And we just thank you for the role that you've given us. The Terry's share this morning was so good, Lord. And to see a clear example of Terry's son up here and Amy's son up here. And Lord, Mrs. Johnson, wherever she is, we just thank you for the moms that we're able and willing to stay home and to raise these men, Lord, and just help us have that lens as we raise our kids in the hard, Lord, and just remember that we are doing kingdom work by doing all the little repetitive things every day, Lord. So thank you for this morning, and in your name, amen.
Let's give it up for our pastors.